tales of success and failure in the classroom. As an introduction, for those of you who don't know me, I've only taught 17 years, still learning a lot. I come from a family who either cared for as foster parents or adopted 56 children. I'm one of three homemade children. My parents adopted four others. When Brother Mervin was talking, this morning, I've got three of those little brothers. I'll tell you about two of them tonight, Lord willing. Because tonight, I'm planning on telling stories. This teaching method is modeled after our Savior, Jesus, of whom it was written, "All these things spake Jesus unto the multitude in parables, and without a parable spake he not unto them." I don't profess to teach as well as he taught, but I will attempt to follow his methods. Like Jesus, I want to tell you a story and then discuss its meaning. So I will be asking for input from you. What I want you to try to find are maxims, short sayings, proverbs, if you please, in a single sentence that boil down the truth that we can learn from these stories. For example, a maxim for the story of David and Goliath might be, "God can use little people," or "a little faith goes a long way." So, I will tell a story and then give you an opportunity to share a maxim. In fact, if you have a pen and paper, please write a maxim down, or two, or three, as I am telling a story. Most of them have more than one valuable lesson. There will be microphones available so that everyone can hear you share your thoughts. These stories involve real people in situations that are being faced in many schools. They expose some of my own failures, and I want you to feel free to criticize my actions. It's part of learning together. Where necessary, I have endeavored to conceal the identity of the characters, as these situations have played out in many communities. I ask that you avoid attributing actions to people you know, but rather to look for the lessons in these stories. Are there any questions about what to expect? Are you ready? Let's begin. The first story is, there's a word for that. My parents brought foster baby Jeremiah home from the hospital when he was 6 days old. He was a cute, blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy. What they didn't know was that his mother had been a cocaine addict and that Jeremiah's mind had been unalterably damaged. In fact, he seemed fairly normal until about 2 months old, when he started screaming and wouldn't stop. In fact, he seemed to be undiagnosable for years. When he was finally diagnosed as a severely autistic boy, by that time, by the time he was school age, he knew only a few words. His main form of communication was still screaming, pointing, or otherwise trying to help us understand him. Thankfully, our county had an excellent special needs school. Jeremiah began attending with a vocabulary in the 20s or so, and after several years, he could say or sign well over 100 words. But those words allowed him to communicate with us about his basic needs without losing his temper. This freedom that my little brother experienced as a result of a talented special education program has increased my gratitude for those who teach slow students and who teach them well. Our family also adopted a Puerto Rican boy named Josiah. His mother had consumed copious amounts of alcohol that damaged his brain. He's much better at communicating, but still developmentally delayed. He needed weeks of speech therapy to conquer the art of speaking clearly. But what is truly amazing about his education is that he can read. This was no small feat. My parents collaborated with our church school to have him attend school several days a week for the social interaction, while my mother took care of most of his actual teaching at home. She used an extremely simple system, and Josiah began reading. This changed his world. Today, he texts prolifically and reads magazines as well as his Bible. We are grateful for all those who help to broaden his horizons. And if you give him your phone number, quite likely he'll text you. Maxims, you're up. If you would, raise your hand so that someone can bring you a microphone. Thank you. Right up here, Wendell.
I thought of a verse. You do it unto the least of these, you do it unto me. I highly respect your parents for that. And also, the possibilities were almost endless. Like this, how they developed accordingly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next story, titled While I Awake at Night. My first classroom contained five slow learners at various stages in their education. One was an eighth grade girl who was doing third grade work for her second year. The school board tasked me with inching her farther up the ladder of understanding. They didn't expect miracles. They only wanted to see progress. But 14 other students in five other grades kept their teacher hopping. Emily, on the other hand, was content to sit peacefully in her desk and watch the world go by. Teaching her proved to be challenging in every level. She excelled at obscure areas like playing quarterback or wide receiver in tag football. But in most realms, she puttered calmly near the back of the pack. Her social skills were minimal, so it took some not-so-subtle persuasion to get the other girls to include her at lunch and so on. We tried several different curriculums, new methods, and even a study buddy. These efforts seemed to assist her in accomplishing assignments, but not necessarily in learning. At the end of school term, the students took achievement tests. The results were amazing. Most of the students had progressed admirably. However, Emily scored exactly the same as the previous year, if not lower. I still lie awake at night sometimes wondering what I could have done better to help her, but now all I can do is pray. She stays in a girl's home where she will likely live out her days. Her memory haunts me each school term, and similar challenges unpredictably arise in even brighter students. I lie in bed at night and ask myself and God at the end of the school term, what am I going to wish I had done? When the answer comes, I endeavor to act upon it, lest another year ends with unattained goals. For example, one cause of insomnia was a young boy who would misbehave and misbehave until finally I punished him. The Lord helped me understand that this was actually a result of insecurity due to a less than ideal home situation. This lad needed to know that I cared enough about him to punish him. And once I had, he felt secure at school for a few more months. I began administering the punishments at his first infraction rather than waiting until things boiled over, and he responded well. We had a great relationship at school, although I punished him about every 2 months. Another insomnia-provoking situation was an upper-grade girl who began struggling with math at the beginning of the school term. She had previously sailed along with ease, so this development left me stumped. Then, while staring into the inky blackness of midnight, the Lord pointed out that she seemed to have forgotten her math facts. Her parents agreed to have her review the facts at home every evening until she remastered them, and to this day, she excels at math. Maxims, you're up again. Thank you.
In regard to the math facts, don't overlook the obvious.
Don't overlook the obvious. Thank you, Lauren. Next story, poor Pierre. Pierre was a bright-eyed first grader, eager to go to school and learn how to read like his big sister. What poor Pierre did not know was that the grown-ups responsible for his education were locked in a teeth-clenching power struggle. You see, the church Pierre had been born into had a history of challenged first and second grade students. The school board did their research and concluded that a change in curriculum was in order. They chose a slightly slower paced curriculum that should have made poor Pierre's education a walk in the park. The teacher turned it into a gauntlet. The teacher had voiced her disapproval of this newfangled curriculum vehemently While the board was researching the options, when the board chose that option against her will, she set out to prove the folly of their pernicious ways. Her efforts began with the book order, in which she purchased only the bare bones of the new curriculum's resources. Worksheets, wall cards, flashcards, and other teachers' helps were intentionally scorned. Who would use that many different tools to teach little people to read? And teachers' guides? Those were for people who hadn't taught school before, right? She chose not to read the instructions or to use their suggestions in her classroom. This well-meaning teacher simply hoped to expose the school board's error. She wanted them to recognize that they had chosen the wrong curriculum and change back to a curriculum that would work. The school term began, and young Pierre and his friends understood from subtle hints that their teacher dropped occasionally that the books that they were using were inferior to the ones their big brothers and sisters had used. Though their teacher tried hard to use the limited resources to instruct her bright young students, the many concepts needed to conquer the art of reading eluded their tender minds, leaving them discouraged with the prospect of more years of feeling stupid and attempting to grasp concepts that dangled just out of reach. The first parent-teacher meeting brought a round of disappointed sighs from concerned parents. The school board inquired, "How's the new curriculum working?" "It's not," the teacher informed them. "It doesn't work. The students are barely learning anything. They just stumble through words and have no idea what they're reading." The school board deliberated but determined that it would be prudent to continue trying these new books for the remainder of this term and see how the students performed by the end of the school year. Pierre and his classmates struggled valiantly through that year, yet their double efforts yielded stammering, disjointed reading that sounded painful to anyone who heard them read out loud. The school board scrapped the idea of the new curriculum as the devastating wreckage of their failed experiment crashed and burned. Unbeknownst to them, their choice had been correct. Later, this school would successfully switch to an easier curriculum, and more of the students would succeed in the classroom. Of this group of students, Pierre is the exception. When in the eighth grade, he finally had a breakthrough because there was a first grader in his classroom, and after 8 years of schooling, he got to hear first grade done right. Several of his classmates were not so fortunate. To this day, reading in public is embarrassing for them and stirs empathy in anyone who listens. Maxims. Right up here.
Being effective is more important than being right.
Being effective is more important than being right. Thank you, Willie. Anyone else? Danny over here.
I thought of the saying, or I kind of made it up, when adults fight, the innocent suffer.
When adults fight, the innocent suffer. Thank you. I think we'll keep moving. Next story is called What's for Lunch? Quinn and his wife looked forward to sending their young children to school in their new church. Lindsay had taught school herself and enjoyed watching the students' progress through new material. They eagerly attended their first parent-teacher meeting, expecting glowing reports of their son Homer's progress. It was not to be. The well-meaning teacher laid it all out for them. "Homer is a spoiled brat who needs much more discipline than you're giving him at home. We can barely control him. Oh, and his lessons, I'm not sure that he will ever learn to read. He can't hold still long enough to carry a thought in his mind, much less to his paper. And his playground behavior is atrocious. You should really consider having him practice playing with other children." The browbeating continued until Quinn and Lindsay stumbled from the room with tears winding down their haggard faces. The admonitions about discipline and training continued through that first school term, and by the time their second child entered first grade, they cautiously held out hope that this would improve. But no. Now, with two slow learners in school, the school board increased the pressure. "You are failing to properly discipline these children. You must do something fast before they get too old." "Could there be another explanation?" Quinn begged. "These children do fine at home. Is it possible that they have some sort of learning disability?" "Don't make excuses now," they were admonished. "If you discipline your children properly, things will improve." Am I just doomed to raise a bunch of dummies? Quinn wondered as he held a handkerchief out for Lindsay again. Nothing improved. Quinn and Lindsay sent several more children to school who handled it with ease. But when another child entered first grade exhibiting signs that he was also wired differently, something had to change. With several normal students in the family, the discipline issue didn't quite carry so much weight. The school board suggested, have you done any allergy testing or done an isolation diet? Would you consider the Barton program? Quinn and Lindsay replied, yes, yes. When gluten was removed from the diets of the two oldest children, their grades immediately improved. They could focus on what was being taught. Their behavior improved as they found themselves more subdued. Quinn could hardly believe it. What did it take us so long to figure it out? How could we have caught this sooner? Their third slow child detested reading until he completed the Barton program. Now he is a bookworm, anxious to catch up on all the reading he missed. Maxims. Thank you, Derek.
Don't judge someone unless you've walked in their shoes.
Don't judge someone unless you're walking in their shoes. Thank you, Willie.
This is something that I can't remember his name right now. Jonathan Erb said in the talk in the balcony earlier today, but he said, don't rush to make every problem a moral problem.
Don't rush to make every problem a moral problem. Thank you. Got one more here.
Ignorance is rarely bliss.
Ignorance is rarely bliss. Thank you. I appreciate these various viewpoints. Next story is called Aiden and Son. Aiden was an adopted boy from the Midwest. While he adjusted well to his new home in a Mennonite community, he faced an uphill battle in the classroom. He struggled to grasp basic reading. By second grade, he had concluded, I'll do only what it takes to pass. And even that was difficult. Several of his school years were overshadowed by clouds of failure, yet somehow he managed to eke by. He graduated with a sigh of relief and a desire to avoid reading from then on. Aiden married a caring young lady, and together they hatched their own brood, who bore a striking resemblance to their handsome father and loving mother. But as their children began school, Aiden realized that his inaptitude for reading had passed to his offspring as well. A benevolent young sister shepherded his first graders so that the work proved doable for their oldest son. But a professional matron in the rigorous second grade room drove him into a brick wall. She promptly declared him a dyslexic and placed him in the venerable Barton program without so much as a, "Mother, may I?" Aghast at this sudden turn of events, Aiden fumed. Are my children dumber than I was? Does this teacher have the right to diagnose my son, remove him from the normal classes, and start him on some newfangled curriculum that we've never heard of without asking us? Am I just raising a tribe of idiots? What if this gimmick doesn't work? Are they going to ask me before making another decision about one of my children? Is this all my fault, or does this teacher have it in for my son? Aiden's gentle wife calmed him and scraped him off the ceiling. Suggested, honey, why don't we support this decision and see what happens? What if it does help? This highly trained teacher must be right. And so they waited and watched. Their son performed well while working through the Barton program, and the parents became hopeful that good things would come. They didn't. The poor boy slid backward as soon as he exited the Barton program. He moved on to another classroom and slogged through his final years of education under the shadow of a failed intervention. The years fluttered by, and several of Aiden's daughters fared blissfully well in the halls of knowledge. His second son entered the ranks of eager first graders. The brave lad soldiered through first grade with the generous aid of a loving teacher. But alas, when he entered the ranks of the tousled heads beneath the practiced gaze of the professional teacher, she spotted him, another son of Aiden, with that distressed dyslexic malady. At first, at the first parent-teacher meeting, she mentioned, "This son also has a propensity for avoiding reading, which to me is an obvious sign of dyslexia and shows that he should be placed in the Barton program immediately, just like your older son was." Aiden's blood boiled. His hands began sweating, his jaw clenched, and he rushed from the room. His level-headed wife rushed out after him. "Aiden, could you please come in and talk?" He shook his head vigorously. "I can't. I'm afraid I'll say something I shouldn't. You go talk to her." He turned and marched resolutely to the car. Soon began a Mexican standoff in which Aiden refused to attend parent-teacher meetings, and the teacher continued to pressure them to put their second son into special ed. Aiden's brother asked me to call him and try to mediate. Aiden filled me in on the story as I have related it to the best of my memory. After speaking with Aiden's board chairman and the teacher in question, I called Aiden and asked him, "Wouldn't you be willing to talk with his teacher if we schedule a conference call with you, your wife, your board chairman, the teacher, and me?" To my surprise, Aiden replied, "I would." I pressed on. "If the rest of us conclude that your son needs to be in the Barton program, would you be okay with that?" "I would." We had a pleasant conference call that lasted over an hour. The teacher agreed to try some milder accommodations before putting the child into special ed. The parents agreed to help him at home. Aiden established communication with the teacher again, and together they worked through last year. Recently, after giving me permission to share this story, with the names and a few details changed, Aiden stated, "We have hope for the upcoming school year. We were relieved when the last school term was over, but our teacher worked especially hard to make it a good year for our son. He'll have a different teacher this coming year, and I just hope she has a heart. I don't care how smart she is. I just want to know if she's got a heart for my son." Maxims, you're up.
Parents don't care how much the teacher knows. They just want to know how much she cares.
Thank you.
Not all diseases are healed with the same cure.
Not all diseases are healed with the same cure. Thank you. Next story is called Eugene's Tongue. Eugene's mother guzzled more than her share of alcohol while expecting him, effectively damaging several important regions of his as-yet-unborn brain. He was adopted at a very young age by a loving family who showered him with care and endeavored to train him in the way of truth, as they had their biological children. Eugene responded well during her first few years of school, but as he matured, he exhibited a propensity for concocting not-so-white lies to cover his misdeeds or even to direct the blame toward one of his siblings. Eugene also began practicing various forms of subterfuge to find ways of getting out of chores, getting more than his share of treats, sometimes by sneaking them, and getting others to believe that he was smart, wealthy, and just generally a very important person. And through it all, he struggled to connect his actions to their consequences. For him, punishments were only bumps in his busy schedule. He did very well in first grade. Learning came easy for his quick mind. In fact, he could easily engage in various forms of forbidden activities and still finish his work on time. His antics served to distract and hinder other students as they tried to complete their assignments. When other students accused him of his misdeeds, he vehemently denied any wrongdoing. With time, he gradually developed a me versus them mentality, which only complicated each infraction and turned normal discipline into a courtroom production for his teachers. He would declare, "You believe them because they're from a different family. You never listen to what I say. You just take their side and punish me because you just believe whatever they say I did. You're my worst teacher, and the last teacher actually trusted me some of the time. This isn't fair. I'm going home. I'm going to tell my family how you treat me." And he kept that promise religiously. He learned the art of playing one adult against another, eventually effecting an end-of-term release of one of his teachers after sowing discord between her, his parents, and the school board. He entered my classroom in the middle grades with a number of negative school experiences tainting his view of education. He was exceptionally adept at subterfuge and misdirection. Lying had become so much a part of him that he would often lie when the truth would do just as well. Teaching him required much discernment. He was prone to making scenes on the playground. Often I'd send him back into the classroom to cool off, and after a few minutes would go in to discuss his infraction with him. And once he settled down, we'd go back out and play a few minutes of tranquil recess before returning to our lessons. I faced many chances to discipline Eugene, but found it required discernment to pick my battles wisely. One afternoon, while playing hide-and-seek, a younger student was shot in the head with a bungee cord. When I attempted to discern which of my big boys would have done such a despicable thing, they all soundly denied it. I was reasonably certain that Eugene had done the persecuting, but no one had seen him, and he waxed eloquent, verifying his innocence. I typically don't punish someone without proof, so I comforted the sobbing child and allowed the other pupils to continue the game. No one ever confessed. Eugene's verbal inexactitudes continued to plague his life after school. And as he realized that money doesn't grow on trees, he became adept at permanently borrowing goods from others to support his own lifestyle. A nagging drug problem exacerbated his fraudulent inclinations, causing him to steal from his own brother's family and to attempt to rob his own parents in broad daylight. Today, he's tiptoeing around while on probation, hoping to avoid another night or two in jail. But if you ask him how he got into so much trouble, he'll proclaim, "I never got caught with my own drugs. You see, I was just driving down the hill with my buddy's backpack on the floorboard. The cops pulled me over and asked if I minded if they called a canine unit. I said, sure, go ahead. I ain't got nothing to hide. I told them whose bag it was, but when they brought that dog, sure enough, there were drugs in it. And now if I get caught with somebody else's drugs with me, I'll get thrown in jail. The only thing I can do for him is pray. Pray and pray. Maxims. We've got one over here, Nola. Thank you. Would you raise your hand again so he can see you? There you are.
Small choices today affect our life tomorrow.
Small choices today affect our life tomorrow.
Do your best, to God leave the rest.
Do your best, to God leave the rest. Thank you. Very good. We'll go on to the next story. The story is called Slaughterhouse Dave. Aquila Martin is a seasoned special education teacher from Pennsylvania who gave me permission to share several of his stories. I'm actually only going to share one. One of his students, we'll call Dave, came to Aquila as a seventh grader with a very specific problem. He could not memorize his math facts. Aquila tested Dave's ability to do basic math operations and found him quite adept at processes. Yet simple facts stumped him, as did his ability to remember right and left. Or wait, is it right and left? If I turn around, it's the opposite, right? Aquila decided to use a reward to motivate this boy to learn his math facts. Dave is mechanically inclined, so Aquila offered him a ratchet set if he would learn 100 math facts. Dave applied himself diligently, and eventually he learned 100 math facts. Aquila gave him the ratchet set, and Dave promptly forgot 100 math facts. Maxims. Is no one brave enough to speak? We've got two. Thank you.
I'm not sure if this makes sense or not, but I was just thinking easy come, easy go.
All right, easy come, easy go. Denny up here. Thank you. It was very brave of you, by the way.
This isn't actually so profound, but ratchet sets do not equal math facts.
Ratchet sets do not equal math facts. Dave graduated. I'm sorry, go ahead.
What you win them with is what you win them to.
What you win them with is what you win them to. Thank you for that. That leads right into the rest of the story. Dave graduated without mastering his math facts or his directions right and left. He began working in a local butcher shop where his mechanically inclined mind flourished. COVID set in and the workload at the butcher shop nearly doubled. Confusion reigned as Dave's fellow employees struggled to follow his instructions to find various customers' meat in the walk-in freezer. Dave could never keep it straight. Which side was the right side? If it was on his right on the way in, it was on his left on the way out. And the back was random. Dave's skill with everything else helped them to have patience with him, and so they just designated the sides of the walk-in freezer as this side, that side, and the back. Dave's skill and work ethic gained him more and more favor with the boss. And finally, he became the second in command. Recently, Brother Aquila had the privilege of working for a summer under his own student. He was amazed at his young man's effectiveness in the workplace. Dave is easily able to combine spices, sugars, and salt to turn a tub of ground meat into tasty bologna, sausage, or whatever the customer wants. To do this, he is constantly changing the proportions of ingredients to match the weight of the meat. On top of that, Dave now retains an accurate catalog of the prices of various meats and other items sold in the butcher shop, all firmly cemented in his memory. Aquila is amazed at this slow student's fast progress in the workplace. And as if attaining a managerial position in a respected business wasn't enough, Dave recently purchased a nearby hot dog factory. Yet Dave, now able to perform complex mathematical calculations, proportions, profit margins, and so forth, still does not know the answer to 5 times 5. What do you think of that? Maxims. We've got one up over here, Nolan. Thank you.
I had to think of the verse, cast the bread upon the waters, and thou shalt find it after many days.
Very good. Thank you for that. Cast thy bread upon the waters, and thou shalt find it after many days. We've got one over here. Thank you.
Success looks different in many different situations.
Success looks different in many different situations. Anyone else?
Sometimes you can look smart in the eye and not recognize it.
Sometimes you can look smart in the eye and not recognize it. Thank you.
They say many times the smartest people in the class are employed by the dumbest people in the class.
Okay. I'm not sure who they is, but he said they say many times that the smartest people in the class end up working as employees for the dumbest people in the class. Very good. Thank you. I have one last story. It does not take place in the classroom, and yet it is a powerful story. It has changed part of my teaching, particularly relating to slow people. The story is called Filtered Feelings. Dick Walters trudged down the broad intensive care hallway beside his sister. He patted her shoulder reassuringly. "Sepsis," she sniffled. "Well," Dick explained, "our bodies typically fight off infections, but sepsis occurs when an infection overwhelms our immune system. The doctors will try the best antibiotics that we have, but kidney infections can be fatal. When they do the dialysis culture, I'll have a chance to find out what is killing him. Do you think he's going to die? She queried. If he can make it through tonight, and if he doesn't? Well, sepsis can kill very quickly. Once the infection takes over, I'm sorry. Dick paused to gather his thoughts. If he passes during the night, I should still know what took him in a couple days. These cultures are challenging. Dick's shoulders slumped as he escorted her to the elevator. They rode down in somber silence. Dick had been a clinical laboratory scientist, specializing in microbiology for over 40 years. During that time, opportunities to use his skill in the hospital laboratory to help his family had been few. Now he could at least identify the type of bacteria that was killing his brother-in-law. It likely wouldn't save his brother-in-law's life, yet it would bring the family some kind of closure to know the name of the enemy that stole their loved one. He looked forward to working on the culture with bitter curiosity. For once, his years of education and decades of experience would benefit his family. He crawled into bed, hoping against hope that his brother-in-law would survive the night. At 3 o'clock the following morning, Dick's alarm rang, and shortly after, his phone buzzed. He saw his sister's number on the caller ID and answered the call. His shoulders slumped as he heard subdued sobbing on the other end of the line. "He's gone, Dick," she sniffled. "He slipped away 20 minutes ago." I'm so sorry. I'd hoped. Do you want me to come over?" "We're fine. They transferred his body to the funeral home, and we'll have to wait till morning to do the paperwork." I'm sorry. So sorry."
"Don't be. There's nothing any of us could have done. I'll call you later when we have more details."
Dick hung up and prepared for his shift in the lab. "I hope that culture was handled properly. Who's the assistant this morning?" "Oh, yes, that new guy. Hope Luis trained him on this procedure well enough." Dick shuffled through the dreary drizzle after he'd parked his car. Carefully, he climbed the slippery steps up the hospital's lab entrance. Once inside, he wiped his feet dry on the rug before he ambled down the broad hall to a steel door marked with the biohazard symbol. Dick mechanically entered the code, stepped inside, hung his jacket on the back of the door, and pulled on his crisp white lab coat, as he had done for over 40 years. He made a beeline for the incubator stacked full of petri dishes, growing bacteria from last night's cultures. The racks were nearly full. Must have been a busy night. Hoisting the first rack from the incubator, he pivoted and slid to his workbench. "Good morning, Dick," the new assistant greeted, while busily recording temperatures and restocking supplies for the coming days. "Morning," Dick replied absently. He was already anticipating the cultures from his deceased brother-in-law's kidneys. "For once, I can be the hero in the family and give the murderer a name." Dick unstacked the sets of petri dishes, beginning with those finished most recently, and progressing through the stack toward those cultures that would have been in the incubator long enough to grow. "Here it is." His eye caught the set bearing his brother-in-law's last name. "Now, to see the filter, it should be in the blood auger plate. Wait, is it in the chocolate? The chrome? Where's the filter?" He was on his feet. In a moment and in seconds, he stood beside the new assistant. Dick's hands trembled as he held the offending stack of petri dishes in front of him. "Oh, where's the rest of this?" he demanded. "Oh, the rest of the filter. What'd you do with the filter?" "The filter from the dialysate." I followed Luis's instructions and pumped liquid through the filter 3 times, prepared the cultures, and threw it away."
"You what?"
Dick's entire body was trembling now.
"I threw it away.
It was in a biohazard bag that the housekeeping crew took an hour ago."
"Don't you know that the liquid is pumped through the filter to concentrate it, that the filter is then placed on the blood auger, and that the other plates are cultured from that? Can't you follow a simple set of instructions?"
A volcano of rage boiled in Dick's chest. His pulse pounded, his hands clenched and unclenched. "I could have this youngster fired in minutes." he fumed. But Dick had been here before. Many others had disappointed him in his life. He faced the stunned assistant squarely, took a steadying breath, and launched forth. You see, young man, the liquid collected during a dialysate is extremely diluted. That is the only way we can acquire a sample culture from patients suffering from infected kidneys. Dick's heart rate and breathing began to subside. The purpose of running the liquid through the filter multiple times is to catch as many of the offending bacteria as possible in the filter. Otherwise, we have no hope of growing enough of the pathogen to properly work up a culture and find a suitable antibiotic. The assistant's face projected the realization of the magnitude of his failure. So, this culture's worthless? He eyed the bare petri dishes. Yes, I'm afraid. This one is worthless. Dick slumped against the counter and slowly examined each disc beneath the brightly lit magnifying glass. There's nothing on these plates, he concluded, and his last chance to help bring closure to his sister dropped into the biohazard waste can. With a sigh, he straightened. So let's go over this procedure again. Meticulously, Dick observed the assistant's actions as he worked through the complex procedure step by step. When the assistant completed the final step, Dick critiqued his performance and they started again. Patiently, Dick led the assistant through the steps over and over. And the assistant had completed, until the assistant had completed the procedure perfectly 3 times in a row. Dick patted him on the shoulder. That is the right way to set up a dialysate culture. Thank you, Dick. I think I can actually do it right the next time. I know you can, Dick assured as he stepped out of the lab, headed to the empty break room where he pounded the table and allowed himself to shed a few tears for the life he could no longer save before returning to his workbench to save the lives he could. Maxims. We've got one. Thank you.
Discipline yourself so others don't have to.
Thank you.
He did well with that.
Discipline yourself so that others don't have to. Anyone else? Thank you, Derek.
Sometimes mercy is more powerful than justice.
Sometimes mercy is more profitable than justice.
Powerful.
Powerful. Thank you. Anyone else? One more.
Don't let the failure of yesterday steal the strength for your today.
Don't let the failure of yesterday steal your strength for today. That lab assistant was yours truly. Dick and I became close friends in the lab over the following 4 years, after which Dick passed away rather suddenly. At his funeral, his daughter informed us, "Dad never raised his voice at me. When I made a mistake, he'd just go into teacher mode and instruct until I learned my lesson. I used to dread it, but now, I'll miss those lessons." I realized then that my experience with Dick, in which he chose to teach when he could have chosen revenge, was not an isolated case, but a habit he had nearly perfected. His self-control allowed him to teach even in tense moments. Someday, I hope I can do that. In closing, I again ask that you avoid attempting to discern who was involved in these stories. Some of them are very personal. But rather steer your energy toward learning the lessons from the failures and successes of others. I want to thank those who allow me to share their stories and to thank you for your attention. But most of all, I want to thank God, who's reading my story and your story. Our stories are still being written, yet with God's help, I can hardly wait to read his story. Because if we are his, the rest of our story is his story. Thank you.